Welcome to this week's Undisclosed Addendum. This is Scott Reeder, filling in for John Cryer. I'm a journalist and the host of the podcast Suspect Convictions. In season one, I covered the trials of Stanley Liggins in connection with the death of a 9-year-old Jennifer Lewis. And I'm in the middle of season two, which covers the conviction of Barton McNeil for murdering his 3-year-old daughter, Christina. There's a strong possibility he was wrongly convicted. I'm joined today by the entire Undisclosed team. We have Rabia Chowdhury, an attorney focusing on immigration law and the New York Times bestselling author of Adnan's Story. She blogs at Split the Moon and also co-hosts 45th Podcast. Susan Simpson is also with us. She's an attorney with Volkov Law Group, specializing in Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. She blogs at View from LL2 and also co-hosts 45th Podcast. Colin Miller is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. He blogs at Evidence Prof. In this week's episode, the team introduced the case of Terrence Lewis, which I just found absolutely fascinating. He was convicted of murder in connection with the death of Houlon Bernard Howard in West Philadelphia in August 1996. We learned that only one eyewitness in that murder was Howard's girlfriend, Lena Laws, who went by the name of Star. Star described the collection of a drug debt gone wrong with one young man fatally shooting Howard and Lewis firing a shotgun into the ceiling. But while this episode noted that Star had no obvious reason to lie, there were some clear problems with her story. For instance, there was no physical evidence that a shotgun had been fired into the ceiling or fired at all in Howard's residence. And then there was Star's admission that she had smoked crack cocaine on a daily basis and had smoked crack about 15 to 30 minutes before Howard was shot. Now, I listened to this and I was just fascinated, and I just have a few questions. One that comes to mind is, how on earth did we come to start investigating the Terrence Lewis case? I just think it's absolutely riveting. Maybe you guys could answer that question.
Yeah, well, this was something where I think it was last October or November, the Pennsylvania Innocence Project had asked us to look into the case of Sean Thomas. And so we investigated that over a number of months. And then as we're getting close to our air date for the podcast, we got the great news that the Conviction Review Unit had thrown out Sean Thomas's conviction. And of course, Rabia did her follow-up series on that and what happened in that case. And while I was looking at some of the articles on the Sean Thomas case, one of them also mentioned the case of Terrence Lewis. And it laid out a really strong and powerful case for his innocence. And it was really shocking to me, based on what was in the article, that this was a case where he was still incarcerated. And so I shared the article with Rabia and Susan. They agreed this was a case we should look at. I contacted Terrence's attorney, and it all started there.
It's interesting because that seems very similar to how I came about working on this particular season I'm working on for Suspect Convictions. I was chatting with the folks at the Illinois Innocence Project and looking at some of their cases, and I came across this case of Barton McNeil, who was served more than 20 years in prison in Menard Penitentiary here in Illinois, just one of the most horrible places on earth to be. I mean, I've been down there a number of times for stories. And he maintained all along that he did not kill his daughter. He is home alone with her, his 3-year-old daughter. And his daughter was suffocated. And he believed that somebody had come in through the window and suffocated her. And the police were very dismissive of that, even though the screens were cut and everything else. The whole time he pointed to his longtime girlfriend, who he had just broken up with, as being the likely culprit. And the judge wouldn't allow him to present her as an alternate suspect in the trial. He was convicted, sentenced to 150 years in prison. And everybody thought that was all she wrote. Then 12 years later, his girlfriend ends up being convicted of murder in this diabolical plot to lure her mother-in-law 100 miles away to come to her town, where she strangles her in her parking lot and ends up burying her in a forest 90 miles away. So there's a lot of things here about this case that really rivet me. And when I look here at the case we're looking at today, I see a lot of similarities in that it's based on very little in the way of witnesses. It's almost all circumstantial. And it just seems like a lot of these cases that we're seeing are based on one or two witnesses, and they're weak witnesses at that. Any particular reason for that, Rabia?
Well, I mean, first, let me just say, for our listeners who haven't listened to the season's Suspect Convictions, and I had the honor of being on your panel discussion a couple weeks ago, it's really one of, I mean, it's a really heartbreaking case. Because, I mean, these kinds of cases in which there's a loved one killed, and there's that trauma for a father to deal with, and then having been convicted and being punished for that, and then the actual... Because I'm fairly convinced, given what I learned about the case, that you're probably right. There's a very strong likelihood that he's innocent. It reminds me a little bit of the Todd Willingham case out of Texas, where he was convicted of arson and killing, I think it was his three children in that fire. And then he was actually executed and later come to, I think, exonerated posthumously. But it's a really tragic case. And yeah, it comes, I mean, with the McNeil case, with your case, it's like he was just there. That's like the only evidence against him, that he was actually home that night. And in this case, you have one ID where, according to that same witness's narrative, there should have been other witnesses. If what she says actually happened, there were a number of people in that house who should have been able to identify Terrence Lewis. And none of that happened. So and Colin and Susan are really leading the investigation on this one. So it's probably good to ask them what they think about the evidence in the case.
I mean, I think this case is like the other ones we've seen in Philly. It's kind of some wrongful convictions happen because the case is scandalous or there's like a family connection or a child dying. And the police are trying really hard to solve that case. And then they just go overboard or they somehow are so dedicated to getting a conviction, they don't really look at what really happened here. Then in other cases, the problem seems to have been that no one cared about any of it. And they have a pretty crappy case and a pretty crappy defense. And a conviction happens to happen, and so be it. I think this is definitely one of the latter cases where they weren't trying that hard to solve this case. It didn't take that much to get the conviction, and now that they have, they're going to hang on to everything they've got. But it's not like they went out of their way to do this. Like they didn't. There was no massive case built together. It was a very flimsy, small case with one witness. But that's all they needed.
And a bad witness, kind of like in Adnan's case. A bad witness, not even like a consistent
witness.
But
in Adnan's case, they did try and corroborate it. They went.
Right.
I don't think Adnan would have been convicted on one witness. They felt like they had to try harder. They wanted to solve really bad. In this case, they didn't care enough to try harder.
You know, what kept running through my mind, it reminded me a little bit of my first season of Suspect Convictions, where we were dealing with Stanley Liggins. They got focused on one guy real early and just kind of built the whole case around that idea rather than some other things. I guess one of the questions I have is, was there any particular reason that Terrence, other than Starr's testimony, obviously, that that Terrence Lewis would have been on the police radar screen?
No record, nothing like that. We mentioned in the photo array, they had a bunch of student IDs from Overbrook High School, and that's because they had no other photo to use of Terrence.
And that's encouraging. I just find it curious that they focused in on this one fellow right away and didn't really go beyond that, it seems like. I mean, it seems to me like they did kind of a sloppy job. I think part of it might be that if the deceased is not necessarily the most sympathetic of figures, he was involved in the drug trade. But what's sad about this is they seem to have focused in on somebody who very well may not have done this at all. And that's troubling.
Yeah, Scott, I mean, you mentioned circumstantial evidence before, and you know, in many of these cases, weak as it might be, there is some circumstantial evidence. In this case, literally, it is Lena Laws. It is Starr who, and we'll discuss this further, at some point makes the identification of Terrence Lewis, but there's no physical evidence tying Terrence Lewis to the crime. There's no evidence connecting him to the other two perpetrators. The physical evidence, as we said, at the crime scene doesn't really match what Lena Laws has to say. So we really, in this case, maybe more so than any other case we've covered or any case I've seen, are relying upon the word of one eyewitness who has this crack cocaine habit, who used crack cocaine soon before the shooting. And that's really troubling, especially when, as Susan said, this is a case where Terrence Lewis has no criminal record. He is a high school student who is working two jobs at the time he's arrested. And it really seems, I'm pretty much positive, this is a case of a miscarriage of justice. Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
Yeah, you know, one of the questions that comes to my mind is, where is Star now? What happened? Or Lena Laws, or whatever we want to call her, what happened to her?
I don't think her life changed much after this. I know there's been attempts to talk to her by other attorneys in the case. It was not successful. From what I've heard, she had a boyfriend that sort of stopped any questioning before it could happen. But I don't think there's much changed after this case.
Has she ever recanted or changed her testimony?
No one's really talked to her again. I mean, she's still, as far as I'm aware, she's still on drugs. She's still somewhere in Philadelphia, it sounds like. But she's never really been questioned again. And, we're left with what she said at trial.
I'll be making a trip to Philly soon. Maybe I should.
Don't go alone.
Don't go alone.
From what I've heard of the last people who tried to talk to her, yeah.
All right. That's what his attorneys have said, is a private investigator went out and was able to locate her and started talking to her. But then this boyfriend came out and it got pretty bad pretty quickly. And so, yeah, it might be a little bit dicey to try to actually meet with her in person at this point, at least.
You know, I've done a lot of interviews like that over the last 30 years. I mean, I'd love to be the one knocking on that door. I think it'd be a very interesting experience. And you never know. I'm always surprised at who's willing to talk and who isn't. I mean, it sounds to me like it's the boyfriend that was the problem here in getting her to talk, not necessarily her.
Well, Scott, in your journalistic career, have you ever had a situation where you've gotten to interview someone and it has either gotten physical or you felt it was close to getting physical?
Oh, yeah. Why don't you ask me if I breathe? Yes, I've been in some situations like that. I mean, I did a major investigation a number of years ago. I had a guy who was making death threats. I mean, you know, that were credible death threats. I've been in situations where it can get kind of dicey, but you know, that's why you get into journalism. I mean, you're searching for the truth, and if you're not going to take some risks to get that information, then you're probably in the wrong profession, just the way I look at it. So I guess one of the questions is, did Terrence get an able defense? I mean, you know, there's only one witness against him. What kind of defense did he end up getting? I mean, it didn't say, at least I didn't hear in the podcast whether it was a public defender. I was assuming it was, but I'm not sure of that. Did he get a good defense?
Yeah, I mean, he had a private attorney, and after the trial, that attorney ended up submitting an affidavit that was explaining his behavior in terms of what he did and didn't do in preparing for this trial. So we'll go into the details later, but it is something where the attorney himself acknowledged this was not the type of representation he typically gave to his clients.
Gosh, getting an attorney to admit a mistake is almost as hard as getting a doctor to admit a mistake. So that's saying something. I say that in the presence of three attorneys who are supposed to laugh at this point. But anyway.
Well, it's interesting. There is sort of a dichotomy there. There are some attorneys who are extremely stubborn and not willing to admit any mistakes. And then there are attorneys out there who, quite frankly, are very willing to fall on their sword and say, look, I made a mistake. I think you convicted the wrong person. And here's exactly where I made an error. And I sort of throw myself at the mercy of the court and ask you to take into account that mistakes were made. And I think I gave subpar representation to my client.
Yeah, I think there's definitely exceptions to that. But a lot of defense attorneys do feel strongly that that's part of their duty. You know, if they take a misstep, you fall on that sword hard.
Well, you know, I've experienced a very different sort of thing. In fact, I found a fair amount of hostility sometimes towards innocence projects because attorneys feel like, a lot of times these defense attorneys are dealing with prosecutors every day. They have this relationship. They don't want to rock the boat. And a innocence project comes in here and throws a brick in the punch bowl. They really will sometimes get uptight about that, which I'm really encouraged that your experience has not always been that you're finding attorneys that are willing to say, you know, I screwed up here, or I made a mistake, or he didn't get the type of representation that he deserved from me. So I find that very encouraging.
Yeah, and Scott, I think that sort of ties back to what you noted before about the weakness of the state's case. I think it's not going to be a perfect alignment, but if you look at cases where attorneys are willing to admit mistakes versus those where they aren't, you know, the stronger the case for the prosecution at trial, the likelier the defendant is guilty, and defense counsel in that type of case is likely to say, you know, maybe I made some mistakes, I'm not going to admit to those on the record, but look, they probably got the right guy. Whereas I think for a lot of the cases we've covered, and specifically these Philadelphia cases, Sean Thomas case, obviously a case of a wrongful conviction, Willie Vesey and now Terrence Lewis, these are exceedingly weak cases, and they're cases where the attorneys at trial strongly believe that their clients were innocent. And I think that makes the attorney a lot more likely to say, look, some errors might have been made and a few things different here and there could have produced a different outcome.
Yeah, you know, having never been an attorney, I've always wondered what it's like to represent somebody that you are wholeheartedly convinced is innocent and have a conviction happen. Is that something that just hangs over your head for the rest of your life? How does that work exactly? I don't know. Yeah. You guys have, I've interviewed attorneys that have been in that situation and talked to them, but I've obviously never experienced that myself. I can't imagine if there's a level of guilt that goes with that, or if there's just a level of frustration, or maybe a little bit of all those things. I don't know.
Yeah, the attorneys that I've spoken to who have found themselves like in a situation where they feel really, really strongly that their client's innocent, but they lose the case, have always kind of said the same thing where like for years, they'll just be haunted with the case. They can't stop. Like it never leaves them in a sense, even if they don't represent that person anymore, they will always go back and keep checking up and seeing what happened in the case. Some attorneys will keep in touch with those defendants or clients. And even in Adnan's case, I mean, one of his bail attorneys after like, I don't know, 12, 13 years had read an article that he about something, you know, like new, he thought it would be a new way to get him in front of court again if he did this new brain scanning technique, kind of like a lie detector on drugs or something. But he reached out because and after all those years, he's like, you know, I've never stopped thinking about it. And I've heard this over and over from different attorneys too, where it just sticks with them. Not just attorneys, but even investigators who work with defense counsel and were like, man, this was, you know, something really went wrong here. And they haven't been able to forget it. But of course they have to move on and there's other defendants they have to think about.
I've interviewed police officers, police detectives over the years who, that's the greatest fear in life, is they're going to build a case against somebody who they'll later find out is innocent. And, you know, I was talking to one who's at the end of his life right now, and, you know, he talks about, you know, that's always the worry. You know, you look back on your career of 30, 40 years in law enforcement, and did somebody go to prison because you made a mistake or you didn't do what you were supposed to do? So
I think the reverse is true too, though. I think in the reverse also happens where they do not want to risk accepting the fact they may have done that to someone. So their denial kicks in and they'll refuse to consider evidence of innocence because the alternative is too horrifying to contemplate.
I think you're absolutely right on that. And I've encountered that more often than the other, but I have encountered, you know, in a reflective moment, somebody say, you know, I wonder if, you know, and that's one of those things. We mentioned the defense attorney. When I was working on this podcast, Suspect Convictions, I was trying to interview the defense attorney involved in this case because he presented absolutely no witnesses other than the defendant saying he didn't do it. He did not present any expert testimony when there's plenty of scientific evidence that needed to be rebutted and certainly could have been. And when I called him, he goes, you know, I may not be any Perry Mason, but I gave an able defense. I don't want to talk to you. And I go, okay. So it goes both ways too with defense attorneys. I mean, I think sometimes they weren't convinced of their client's innocence, and you know whether that he's found guilty doesn't really particularly bother them. And I think sometimes, I say this with great caveat of sometimes, defense attorneys will have, particularly if you're in a public defender office and you spent your whole career there, I think you can get pretty cynical about who you're representing and forget that sometimes people coming through there are truly innocent of the crimes that they're committing. So I think it goes the whole way. But one thing that struck me, I'm a hunter. In fact, I was sitting in a deer blind last week with a shotgun, and I fired a shotgun a fair amount of times. There is no way you can fire a shotgun in a house and not leave a crater somewhere. I mean, that's just the way it is.
And not leave everyone deaf.
Yes, exactly. I know some hunters that wear ear protection even in the field because they don't want to have hearing loss. So the question I have is, how on earth could a shotgun have been fired in that house? There seems to be no evidence of that.
It wasn't. Yeah, she was. We don't know why Star got it wrong, but she was just wrong. And there's obviously different reasons she might have made that mistake, but it does call into question how well she actually observed the stuff around her that night. Because, yeah, clearly there's no shotgun fired into the roof, the ceiling.
Do you guys think that maybe because, I mean, the police knew that she had been doing drugs, that they kind of, they didn't consider, I mean, like that inconsistency wasn't enough for them to, like, they're like, well, yeah, it's okay. You know, maybe when you're on cocaine, like things are kind of heightened. I have no idea what the experience is like, but maybe it was a pistol and a revolver or something else. And she thought she heard a shot. Like, it just sounded like that. And they just didn't think it was a big enough deal, big enough consistency to discredit the rest of her.
They don't seem as concerned about it as I think I would be like, huh, like this thing, like already I can tell something's really wrong in your story. And they don't really push her on it. They don't really, I mean, they do apparently take a look at the ceiling. They're like, huh, no hole there. But they don't seem to have the kind of alarm I would have if I was faced with a witness like that. As well as with the other things that she says that just kind of are sort of hard to fit with the scene and what we know of the crime. Like there's that weird scene where she describes how when the three men come into the house, they're all talking in the living room. And I don't know the house layout. I wish we did. I wish we had a plan for the room. But apparently there's an issue in that Star talks about how she could see the three men in the front room. And that's the first room you come into. It's like room 1 of 4. And she's in room 3. And they're questioning her about, like, how could she see the three men that were in that first living room? And she's like, oh, there's mirrors everywhere. I could see them in the mirrors. So I guess they could have had mirrors set up in a way where, like, it kind of reflects across. I don't know. But then she also describes how, like, one of the men with a shotgun comes back and, like, gives them all, like, a side eye, I guess, in the room 3 and then walks back to the first room. But she doesn't seem alarmed by this. And then the whole scene of the shooting itself with, like, all 7 of them crammed into a pretty tiny space with, like, table and, like, I just have to imagine it'd be super packed in that room, which never really comes up. But I don't really understand how the thing Star's describing could have happened in the space she puts it in.
Yeah, and another thing is, in terms of the shotgun and firing it, we'll discuss this in more detail when we get to trial, but in essence, it seems what the detectives do is to say, oh, well, you said you saw him fire this sawed-off shotgun into the ceiling. Obviously, that couldn't be what you saw. Here's what you must have seen. And then eventually she just incorporates what the detectives say into the story. And in fact, says, I'm using the terms that the detectives gave me. So that's sort of their way of ironing things out, is to say, you know, clearly you're wrong, and maybe it's because of the drugs, but here's what you actually probably observed, and that's the way it's explained to the jury.
I mean, I can see why they're tempted to do that, because obviously she didn't see the gun fired into the ceiling. So why not be like, okay, honey, here's what you must have wanted to say. When you start going down that road, what else are you changing?
Yeah, and Susan, to the point that you raised in the podcast as well, and I wish we had some audio from the trial or even that we could talk to Lena Laws, but it does seem that she has a pretty severe speech impediment, and we obviously have these varying accounts of the police officers as to what she said. You know, you just wonder with all of these just how much we can take what she said at face value, as opposed to maybe there being some errors in communication just beyond the crack cocaine, just based upon misinterpreting, based on her speech impediment, what exactly she was saying.
Yeah, and it's not clear what kind of sort of impediment she has here. No one's really described the nature of it, other than that for some reason people aren't understanding her.
One question I have is, it was a little unclear to me, obviously it was the kicker at the end of your first episode, but what was the type of wound that was suffered in this case, the deceased had? Was it a shotgun wound?
No, it was a gunshot wound from a handgun. It was just one shot. And what we know is that the sort of the barrel of the gun that was used, presumably a Tech 9, was pressed against sort of the small of its back at a slightly upwards angle. And there was one shot fired, and it came out through close to his navel, which is why Starr and the officers apparently, well, it's why the officers think he was shot in the stomach, and possibly why Starr believed he was shot in the stomach, because they see that wound there, and they assume it's the entrance wound. But again, the entrance wound was in the back. Apparently, it looks like he died of internal bleeding. There was very little blood at the scene. And I guess one thing I also wonder, too, is how the body was found. He was positioned on his back with his head towards the last room, so room number 4, which, based on some other evidence, does seem to imply that the shooter was, like, in the kitchen, possibly, behind him, which is totally inconsistent with what Starr described. But again, without photos, without actual analysis of the crime scene, it's hard to say what's going on.
One question I have is, what about the judge in this case? When this case was tried, did any of these inconsistencies, I guess I've sat through enough trials where I've seen judges sit there and go, wait a minute here, and actually ask some questions of their own. I told that to some other people, and they said, well, what do you mean here? I've seen judges ask questions. I've also seen things happen behind chambers. So is the judge in this case at all interactive in the case?
No, there was not really much fuss about anything, really, at the trial. And they do clean up some of the problems here. I know when I first started looking at this case, and I first sort of reviewed the police files and the materials, I was trying to figure out how they got a conviction here, because everything seemed off. The story seemed sort of, it was incoherent. It didn't hang together well. And then I got to the trial transcript, and it's like, okay, I guess they kind of clean it up, but they do it in a way where it's not really satisfying, but it does make a more simple, straightforward story. So I guess no one was, like, overly alarmed at the time of the trial, although it's still arguably hard to say that it fixes many of the problems that are raised. But I guess the judge himself was not particularly concerned about what was going on. There's no sort of indication that the judge was having doubts here about the state's case.
Yeah, one of the exchanges that I found the most pertinent at trial, where I think the judge was a bit too hands-off, is, as we'll discuss at trial, Lena Laws says, oh, well, after I got clean, and it's debatable whether she got clean or not, I gave another statement, and it sort of cleaned up some of the errors or mistakes I had made earlier when I was nervous and talking to the police. And the defense is saying, well, wait a second, we never got discovery of this subsequent statement by Lena Laws, and so this is a Brady violation, or is there in fact a statement? And in essence, the state says, no, there's no such statement. And of course, the defense is asking for the judge to give some type of instruction to the jury about no evidence of this subsequent statement existing. And the judge just basically says, well, you can just sort that out during cross-examination and allow the jury to hear it. But I think that's something where the judge should step in a case like that, where the only eyewitness to the trial is saying, I made a statement, it clarified prior errors in the case that contradicted with physical evidence. I think the judge needs to step in and say, look, I'm instructing you as the judge. The state is saying there is no subsequent statement by this one eyewitness. I think that's more powerful than just interrogating the police officers and Lena Laws about this statement.
I guess the question is, who do you guys believe? Do you think the state's lying, or do you think the witness on the stand was lying about this subsequent statement?
I don't think anyone's lying necessarily. I don't think Starr is lying. I just think she's very confused. And it's not clear. She did give several statements to the police. We know that she was brought in at least 3 times to look at photo arrays, try and identify the perpetrators. So it's hard to know exactly what she's talking about. And it may be that what she's referring to is just one of the times she came in to identify, look at photos and identify someone.
But I guess one of the things I've noticed in the cases I've covered over the years is a lot of times they involve Brady violations, where something was supposed to be turned over and never was, or whatever. And the question that comes to my mind is, maybe there was this interview that took place, and for some reason, the prosecution just doesn't want to turn it over. And they say it doesn't exist.
Oh, I think that's a distinct possibility.
That's why I'm asking you, who has the least amount of credibility in this? Is it the prosecution, or is it the witness in the case?
This is a topic we'll definitely be exploring in subsequent episodes. I can say that.
Okay. The other question that came to my mind is, a number of years ago, I was a state house reporter for a number of years and here in Illinois, and we had a gunman enter into the state house 3 floors below where my office was, and fire off a shotgun, killing a security guard. And it was a schizophrenic that was on a rampage. And long story, but I'm sitting there in my office with the door closed, three floors above where the shooting took place. And I heard it distinctly. I mean, it startled me to hear it. So, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing that comes to mind about a shotgun being fired, is the whole neighborhood would have heard it. And we don't have any evidence that anybody heard anything. So, I mean, that's troubling to me as well.
You'd think more people would have heard the gunshot we know is fired, too. But all we have is a single witness. I think the very next door neighbor who heard a one shot or a loud bang, which is presumably the shot that killed Bernard Howard. But they didn't seem to try that hard to find other witnesses who presumably must have heard some of the commotion, at least the gunshots.
My experience has been people usually aren't sloppy in a vacuum. That's usually a long pattern of being crappy at whatever job you've done. So that's one of the questions that really comes to my mind on this particular case. These other detectives... These detectives that worked the case, did they have problems in other cases they worked? I mean, I think that's something we really ought to take a look at here. It's just, you know, maybe for a future episode, is just, hey, what's going on with these detectives? Do they have a history of just doing poor work, or what's going on?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it seems like there's often a pattern with the other Philadelphia cases. We're seeing the same detectives' names come up over and over. And I was speaking to Marissa Bluestein, who's the director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and she said that when they noticed like the same names a couple of times, they started digging into other cases. And she's like, they have like maybe a dozen potential wrongful convictions right now that are all connected to the same, like just the same cops keep appearing in them. And I think also, it's true for prosecutors. And so that's the problem, is it's not that oftentimes like the whole department has issues. It'll just be a couple of people, but over the course of, you know, many, many years, they can impact a lot of cases and lives, and they just keep popping up. So it's like a small group of bad apples for whatever reason. I know sometimes it's inadvertent, it's poor practice, but I also think sometimes it's just downright malicious. I mean, I have seen cases where at least the defendant has said that, you know, it was just another Baltimore case I read about the other day, in which the defendant said that when he was being interrogated by the police, the cop said, yeah, I know you didn't do it. And, you know, after many, many years, he was exonerated. So there are definitely some bad players, and they keep, and I personally think that these are the kinds of patterns that like conviction review units or conviction integrity units should look out for, even if there aren't defendants who've come forward to apply, that if they really want to clean house and do right and seek justice, if the same names keep popping up, they should dig a little further and see what other cases these guys have worked on.
I think that's a reasonable thing. One question I had is, what can you tell me about the jury? Do we know what the makeup of it was? Or was it a bench trial for that matter? I guess I'm assuming it was a jury.
It was a jury trial. I have not actually looked into that. I've not read the voir dire or anything. If we have, yeah. Do we have, Colin, do we even have voir dire in this? I don't think we do.
I'm not even sure that we, I'm not sure that the defense ever got the voir dire. I think it does pick up just on day one of trial. I can check with his attorney, but yeah, I haven't actually seen a voir dire. I don't think we have it.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, you know, how many African-Americans were on the jury? What did it look like? That sort of thing. I mean, I'm just curious how that shook out.
The countdown clock is on for the holidays, and you only have a couple weeks left to get all that holiday shopping in, but do not panic, because I'm here to help you. Those of you struggling to figure out how to get all your shopping done, to find the right gift for the people who are so hard to shop for, to find stuff that would please everybody, and to do it all while avoiding the lines and the crowds at the malls, because really, who wants to do that in these last couple of weeks? So let me tell you about one of our brand new sponsors I'm so excited about, Omaha Steaks. Now, I got an Omaha Steaks family gift pack, and I'll tell you all about that in a minute, a couple of weeks ago, and it's been fantastic, because for those of you who follow me online, you might have realized that I have been on a low sugar diet for the last few weeks, and the beginning was a struggle, but you know, it's all based around, like, you know, vegetables and really good protein, so a lot of meat and fish and things like that. And this particular gift box, which, by the way, for our listeners is only $49.99. $49, less than $50 if you go to omahasteaks.com and enter our promo code UA in the search bar. That's 75% off this gift box, by the way. And let me tell you everything you're going to get for the $75. Imagine this coming to somebody's door as a gift and they open this up. 2 filet mignons, 2 top sirloins, 2 boneless pork chops. Admittedly, I gave those to a friend. 2 boneless chicken breasts, kielbasa sausages, 4 burgers, 4 potatoes au gratin, 4 caramel apple tartlets, and they were so good. Okay, I cheated a little on my diet, but they were so good. An Omaha Steak seasoning packet, and an additional 4 sausages for free. That is all for $49.99. It comes beautifully packaged in a box that, you know, keeps them frozen, and they're all packaged in individual portions. It's just an incredible gift. Omaha Steaks has over 500 gourmet gift ideas, and they have the most flavorful, tender aged beef. Their veggies, desserts, appetizers, pasta, soup, seasonings, I mean sauces, you name it. They've got so much there. It is quick. The shopping is convenient. You order online, and there's a lot of online recipes and wine pairings and other ideas to give you to create a delicious meal. So, you know what? I mean, it's not just a great gift. It's great to get it for yourself, especially if you're expecting some company this holidays. So go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code UA in the search bar. So remember to do that first, and you're going to get a 75% savings. It is the gift that's guaranteed to be a hit this holiday.
Susan, there are a couple of things you wanted to discuss. The first is the Department of Justice filing a brief stating that it no longer believes that some federal prisoners serving longer prison terms the law allowed were entitled to challenge their sentences in court. What can you tell us about their position?
Yeah, so a recent sort of position change that's happened in the DOJ has to do with how certain post-conviction proceedings are happened for prisoners who claim that or actually have illegal sentences imposed on them. So for federal prisoners, again, it's people in the federal system, there are several ways they can challenge post-conviction their sentence or the actual verdict in their cases. And for years, what we've done is there's a section of it, it's called the Savings Clause, and it allows prisoners to file a habeas if essentially they have an illegal sentence. And this allowed prisoners who otherwise wouldn't have an option to challenge that sentence to actually get back in court and be like, look, judge, you sentenced me to 10 years in prison, but under the law, at most, you could have sentenced me to 5 years in prison. And previously, this has been accepted. The DOJ has been okay with it. Like, they've endorsed this interpretation of the law. Recently, that's changed. They have now come out in a case, and they're arguing that, in fact, no, the courts do not have the ability to hear these cases. And if someone is imprisoned on a wrongful and illegal sentence, they have to stay there until the sentence is over. They have no right to actually go to court and get this mistake fixed, even if it's now, under the laws interpreted today, unambiguously incorrect.
So where on earth is this coming from?
It's coming from the DOJ. It's definitely coming from the new DOJ and Sessions' policy on criminal enforcement.
Yeah, and the other part of it, too, is beyond the sentence, this is something where the Supreme Court is hearing this case, the McCarthan case, and the DOJ has submitted this brief. And in essence, what the McCarthan case deals with is Mr. McCarthan got what's known as a sentencing enhancement, additional years in his sentence under the Federal Armed Career Criminal Act. And that was based upon his prior conviction for escape, which used to be classified as automatically a violent crime, which then triggered the enhanced sentence. And then subsequently, this was reinterpreted by the court in his jurisdiction to say, well, no, escape in many circumstances is not a violent crime. And so the point of the DOJ now is to say, even if you have been given a sentencing enhancement, a conviction based upon something that's now been deemed improper in your jurisdiction, you can't go back and seek relief. So one thing we've covered, for instance, is the Reed technique, the technique that produces a lot of false confessions. Imagine a case like the Willie Vesey case where a defendant is subjected to certain interrogation techniques and is convicted after confessing, and later that jurisdiction, the state says, well, this technique that was used all these years we find produces coerced and involuntary confessions. DOJ used to say, okay, well, that person can now challenge their conviction and say, look, this technique was used in my case. Now the DOJ is saying, no, if you were convicted and the law at the time allowed for this, even if subsequently we've determined this is an improper technique, we're now saying you can't challenge your conviction or sentence based upon this change in the law.
The other case I was going to ask you guys about is the case of Floyd versus Alabama, What do you think of the Supreme Court's opinion in this case?
Floyd versus Alabama is similar to a case we discussed when we were talking about the Joy Watkins case. It was a case, Foster versus Chapman. This is the case that you might recall was a case of an African-American defendant convicted of murder and given the death penalty. And the prosecutor literally, during voir dire, the jury selection process, had written, say, the letter B next to black prospective jurors' names and had struck them. And of course, the Supreme Court in that case said, oh, this is a violation of our principle from the Batson case, which said that you can't use discriminatory peremptory strikes of prospective jurors. And at the same time that Foster versus Chapman was decided, there was this case out of Alabama, Floyd versus Alabama. It's actually a Caucasian defendant, but the claim is similar, that in essence, the prosecution in the case was striking African-American jurors, who many prosecutors think tend to be more lenient on defendants, both at guilt, innocence, and the sentencing phase. And in fact, same thing as in Foster versus Chapman, had written the B next to the prospective black jurors' names.
Yeah, apparently, and that's like the Southern way of doing this. You just forget all subtlety and just like write a B next to it. Like, yeah, at least get a code there. Like, you're like a little star sign or something.
Yeah, they're making no attempt to hide this. And yet, so what the Supreme Court says is, well, now we've decided Foster versus Chapman. We have this cert petition in Floyd versus Alabama. Let's go ahead and send it back down to Alabama so they can reconsider their opinion in light of our opinion in Foster versus Chapman. And the Supreme Court of Alabama says, no, we're going to uphold the conviction in this case. We don't find that this violates Batson. And so then the defendant in the case had filed a cert petition asking the Supreme Court to hear the case like they did in Foster versus Chapman. And yeah, just recently the Supreme Court said, we're not going to hear this case. And it gets down to procedure, which is that in Foster versus Chapman, there was an objection to jury selection at the time of trial. In Floyd versus Alabama, there was not, which means that you can only review what the prosecutor did for what's known as plain error. And that complicates it a little bit. But still, this is virtually the identical case in terms of what the prosecutor did with these jury challenges, and Supreme Court's just not going to hear it.
Yeah, and it seems like there is definitely a pattern, both in terms of court decisions, more importantly from DOJ policy side, of basically foreclosing avenues of relief or potential avenues of relief for convicted defendants. And it just, the finality part of it has become so important in current DOJ thinking that, I mean, for a lot of the cases we get and are looking at or possibly considering for this show, it's hard to see how anything can ever be done for them, because there's just no way. Like, even if you found perfect innocence, perfect evidence of innocence tomorrow, I don't know what you'd do with it.
And it also, I think, if you look at this opinion, my take on it, I don't know if all of you agree, but it sort of puts the onus on defense counsel and the defendant to assume that the prosecutor is being racist or sexist, because, you know, you're at a trial and the prosecutor is striking a bunch of, let's say, African-American jurors or female jurors, well, maybe you give them the benefit of the doubt and say, I think, okay, maybe this is legitimate. They have good reasons for doing that. And then after you're convicted, you see the actual notes from the prosecutor and they have a B next to the name of the black jurors. And it's like, okay, that gives me the reason to believe this, in fact, is invidious as opposed to happenstance. And I just don't see how you can place the obligation on the defense to assume the prosecutor is being racist and then say, when you discover that fact after trial, that now all of a sudden you can't appeal.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to a lot of defense attorneys who contend that the Batson case is, in a lot of ways, a paper tiger, that the prosecution always can find a reason to strike somebody. They won't ever admit that it's because of race, but they say that they go through that frustration constantly. How do you prove the motivations of a prosecutor in a case like this? Any thoughts on that, guys?
I mean, so the problem is these are all individual cases. You can definitely show like statistically solid trends over a series of cases of the prosecutor. But when you're dealing with a sample size of what? I mean, it's probably 30-ish for the average pool, if not less. It can be harder to really see those trends. Now, of course, there's plenty of places where they're not even bothering to hide it with like excuses. They're just writing B next to the name and then striking them. And they're probably, I mean, Batson's going to hopefully put a stop to that at least. But yeah, there's always going to be room for prosecutors to act in bad faith and abuse it. But I don't think that means that it's not a good thing to at least stop the most obvious and blatant violations of the Constitution.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I'm just, my question is Batson as strong as it ought to be?
Yeah, well, there's, I think a few years ago now, the Supreme Court of New Jersey announced a rule, and that said that if at trial the judge finds a Batson violation, that judge can re-impanel the stricken jurors and usually the prosecutor, sometimes the defense, are sort of left with those jurors. And so that would be a case where, for instance, in New Jersey, let's assume the prosecutor strikes five African-American jurors. The defense objects and says, oh, this is a Batson violation. The judge agrees. Those five jurors, knowing they were struck by the prosecutor, are now sitting on the jury and deciding the case. Now, does that go too far? I don't know, but it's something where certainly you would think twice about your use of peremptory challenges if you knew that this remedy were a possibility.
In last week's addendum, you talked with Justin Brown about some police misconduct lawsuits in Baltimore. Colin, there was a recent news story in the Philadelphia newspaper about this. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, this sort of ties into what you were discussing before about whether these detectives had a history of misconduct, and that's certainly something we're going to check into. But this was a news story toward the end of November, which I hadn't heard about, and I don't know how much attention it got. But essentially, back in 2012, there were these six narcotics detectives in Philadelphia, and they had engaged in such misconduct, planting evidence, lying, fabricating documents, that prosecutors in 2012 threw out 1,000 convictions that were based upon this squad's investigations. They said they were no longer going to prosecute cases brought by this office that had these officers. And the news here updating that was saying that there are essentially 300 lawsuits against these officers in the narcotics squad based upon false convictions, and that Philadelphia has started settling these lawsuits. And basically, the article was saying they could pay up to $8 million to resolve these complaints and could end up paying $16 million to resolve unrelated charges of wrongful murder convictions. So that sort of speaks to one of those issues where, yeah, these are rarely cases of isolated misconduct. It tends to be patterns, and certainly Philadelphia is a repeat offender here.
And also in last week's addendum, you talked with Justin Brown about a new bail law enacted by the Court of Appeals in Maryland. Today, there was an article in the Baltimore Sun this week. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, and this is something actually I just saw that Justin himself had tweeted about too. This was a piece by two student attorneys at the Pre-Trial Justice Clinic at the University of Baltimore School of Law. So as way of background, earlier this year, the Court of Appeals in Maryland said, we need to consider ability to pay in the bail decision because there's too many cases where defendants who are indigent, which is the vast majority of cases, can't post bail. And so the Court of Appeals of Maryland essentially said, we need to look at ability to pay and make sure that we're looking at other factors such as culpability, evidence of guilt, whether this person has a history. And this is sort of a horrific example of the law of unintended consequences. The article is essentially saying this has not led to more bail and not led to more pretrial release. In fact, what it's led to is judges essentially finding, oh, well, we can't set bail that's an amount that's unaffordable. And therefore, rather than lowering bail, they're saying, oh, well, this is a case where there's no amount that the person can post, and therefore this person needs to be detained pending trial. And so it's had the perverse result of actually leading potentially to making it tougher for people to be released pending trial in Baltimore than was the case before.
And in many of these cases, you're talking about defendants that have no prior record, no violent history. And so they're just, instead of reaching, and I think the COSA decision also said that a cash bail should be a last resort, and then it should be adjusted according to means. And I don't know how the assessments are being made in this case, but overwhelmingly, they're just not setting bail. They're like, no bail available for people who have like no prior history. So I don't know what the remedy for that is. Colin, what do you think the remedy for that would be then if this is having literally the completely opposite intended impact, I think, that the upper court ruling meant for it to have?
Yeah, and just, yeah, the example here is they say on October 23rd, there were 24 individuals, all charged with misdemeanors, relatively minor offenses. They appeared before a judge, Judge Jack Lesser. Only two of those individuals were released on own recognizance, meaning they don't have to post anything. Three of those are detained on monetary bonds from $1,500 to $7,500. The remaining 19, so 19 out of 24, are denied bail. And as the article notes, some of those individuals had no prior criminal convictions and no history of violence. This is an Eighth Amendment challenge. Eighth Amendment says we shall not have excessive bail or fines that are imposed. This is something where there are lawsuits across the country. Many jurisdictions have changed their bail laws. And if this is in fact happening with some amount of recurrence, and it seems from the article it is, this is a textbook Eighth Amendment challenge to say, look, this is unconstitutional. It's violating constitutional rights, and send it back to Court of Appeals in Maryland for them to clarify what they meant by this ruling, because certainly this seems contrary to the intended result.
I mean, but how is it not clear what COSA meant? I mean, COSA said setting bails that are basically just unaffordable, people that you know that a person cannot post $100,000 bail or $500,000 bail, setting those, I mean, basically this person can in no way meet that bail. You're detaining them. They're going to be detained until trial. They might lose their home. They're going to lose their jobs. I mean, it's having the exact same impact. Oh, okay, you can't afford any bail, so we just, you get no bail. Same result. You still, you know, all those things. I mean, it can destroy a person's life. If they have to be detained for, let's say, 6 months, a year, year and a half, waiting trial, they can't work. They can't be with family. What if they're a single parent? I mean, there's so many far-reaching implications of it. But the result's the same. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah, when I tweeted this, someone, I guess from Baltimore, said that Brian Frosch, the Attorney General of Maryland, came and talked to his synagogue, and that what he explained about this decision by the Court of Appeals of Maryland is directly antithetical to what's happening. And so that's another avenue of potential relief, is reach out to Brian Frosch. If you live in Maryland, in Baltimore, even outside, just look, send him the article. I don't know if he's seen it, and hopefully he can do something to change the way that at least some judges seem to be interpreting this edict.
Can an attorney general direct a court to interpret it differently?
He can't direct the court to do so, but he could perhaps, in the way that the prosecutors are handling these cases, or maybe do something to address what's going on here, because, yeah, that this just...
He's on Twitter. You guys can tweet at him. I do sometimes.
Good to know. Well, should we go to some of the question? We have a question from one of our listeners. This came from Jennifer T. Lopez. Her question is, it sounds like maybe Starr may have shot him. Maybe she shot him while on the ground as he turned to either walk away or who knows. What's the motive? Jealous of Denise or who knows? Pissed about drugs or lack of? Will there be more about exactly why they didn't talk to Denise or Omar?
I'll say first off that I don't think this is a case, and it's all, of course, again, you always want to look at everything. In this particular case, I don't think there's any reason to believe that Starr herself has any culpability. None of the facts we had, none of the witnesses we have support that. I think she is very confused about what may have happened, but I don't think, from what we know, there's reason to believe she may have been involved in the murder itself. As for Denise and Omar, we'll get more to that later. And they did try to find Omar, and they did end up eventually talking to Denise, even though she didn't appear at trial. And we'll get more into that in probably next episode.
We'll have basically statements from several other witnesses as well. I think this is a fairly clear-cut case where it was not necessarily the way that Starr said it, but three young men who went to this house. They were trying to collect a drug debt. One of them ended up shooting and killing Mr. Howard. I think that's all clear that it was these three young men involved. The point is, I think that same evidence is going to show that one of those men certainly was not Terrence Lewis.
Okay. Well, while we're on the subject of listener questions, I'm trying something I've never seen done before with a podcast. We're trying it in this next week or two. We're going to open up to all of our listeners of suspect convictions to ask the defendant questions, any question they want to ask. We got a guy who's spent 20 years in prison, maintains his innocence. There's a good possibility, frankly, that he is innocent. And we're just going to open up to the listeners who have been listening to the episode so far and let them ask the questions that come to their mind. And we've gotten several questions already, but I'd really invite folks listening to this addendum to get on to suspect convictions, listen to some of the episodes, and then send some questions in on how to what they'd like to ask the defendant in the case. And he'll answer them. We're going to get him on the phone, and he'll respond to each question. So I'm excited about that.
I'm curious, Scott, is that something that the Illinois Innocence Project suggested, or how did the process go about with them approving that?
There's a good thing you learn about as a reporter. It's called better to ask forgiveness than permission. And I just went ahead and pursued it, and the defendant thought it was a great idea, and so he's cooperating. I don't think there's anything really for the Innocence Project to be particularly concerned about, because they are wholly convinced of his innocence, and you know, I think that if he just tells the truth, it's not going to hurt him in this particular case, because it was entirely a circumstantial case against him. His only evidence against this guy was he was in the apartment when his daughter died. So they said he must have done it. That's the extent of it. So I don't think there's a whole lot to worry about as far as, you know, a story changing or anything else, because there wasn't really a story. Anything else we should add in, Rabia?
No, I mean, even in these cases I've seen over and over again, attorneys never want their clients speaking, only because, you know what, I just feel like it's not even a matter of a story changing. It's just a concern that a person might say something that's taken out of context or used again. I've seen this over and over. You know, prosecutors say, oh, well, that person didn't said this, and completely twist what actually happened. But I suppose I'm assuming that he would know what to answer and how to answer. And is he going to be doing it over, like, do you talk to him over the phone, or is it in writing, or how does that work?
We're going to do it over the phone. In fact, throughout this podcast, we've talked to him several times a week, and we routinely do phone interviews with him. And I know attorney's well aware of that. So
yeah,
so I'm very excited about it. I think it'll be a fascinating case.
It's totally different. I don't think anybody's done that before, where the listener is asking questions. That's pretty cool.
So I'm excited about it. I think it should be interesting. In fact, if you'd like to tune in, Robbie has asked one of the questions. So she asked it in the last episode we taped, and we're going to use her voice and have her asking the question to Martin McNeil. So that should be great as well. Again, the podcast is Suspect Convictions. And we'd love for folks to subscribe. But back to Undisclosed. Anything else we should discuss, guys?
I think there's a lot more to talk about in this case, but it's going to have to wait till Susan and Colin lead us through the rest of the case. In the meantime, thank you so much, Scott, for coming on and hosting today's addendum. And we hope, I'm sure everybody agrees with me, we hope you come back sometime.
I'd love to come back. Please invite me.
We will.
All right, thanks, Scott.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for listening to this addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production, Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Talhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.